And welcome to the Public Health Advisory Council meeting. We're going to go ahead and get started. Let's go ahead and do some introductions around the table. I've been absent for the last couple of meetings as well. I'd like to start us off around the table.
Hi, I'm Adrienne Fairbanks. I came to last month's meeting as a guest, and I am a veterinarian that is I'm a predominantly small animal veterinarian that practices right off of 205 and I-5, kind of in the Sand Creek area at Mountain View Veterinary Hospital. I graduated from Michigan State in 2002, and so I've been a veterinarian for a little bit of time, and just moved to Ridgefield about 2 years ago, and kind of have just been interested in public health and just the kind of the human-animal health component to it, as a lot of animal health and human health are integrated. And so I thought it would be really interesting to volunteer opportunity. I think I'm on the board now, or we're maybe going to vote. I don't know. I still don't know yet. I'm in.
Depends on what you say next.
It's still touch and go, but that's my hope, is that I can join the board and be part of it.
You will be shortly. That's your guess.
We don't know. I did drive here white knuckled, trying to make it on time. So.
Thank you.
My name is Sandy Mathewson. I am the new Director of Social and Emotional Learning for the Battle Ground School District. Prior to that, for 23 years, I was at Educational Service District 112 as the Director of Prevention and Youth Services. So it's a new role, and I've been gone because it's been crazy to do this grant, but I'm happy to be back.
Jeff Armisen, I'm the Chief Administrative Officer here at Clark County Public Health. Been here just over 17 years. I pretty much fresh out of college and haven't left. Here I sit.
My name is Bob Richardson. I'm the police chief in Battleground, Washington, and I represent what we call the LEC, the Law Enforcement Council, and that's made up of the sheriff and all the police chiefs in the county. So I sit on this board as their representative.
I'm Steve Becker. I'm technically the public consumer of health services, but my day job is with Daybreak Youth Services, a provider of chemical dependency treatment, inpatient treatment for kids. I grew up in this town a long time ago, left for a long time, and I'm back, and glad to be here.
I'm Anna Pendergrass. I'm the director of 911 and the emergency management down at Prescott.
Scott Johnson. I'm the emergency management division manager at Clark Regional Emergency Services.
I'm Leah Martinez, I'm Emergency Preparedness Coordinator here.
I'm Stephanie Rizamashta, and I'm here representing Nurse Working Park County, and I work at Health in Mental Health Services.
David Scott, City Administrator for the City of Washougal, and I represent all the cities in Clark County except for Vancouver.
My name is Tracy Rubin, and I am here as a public consumer member, and I'm currently working for the Nursing Commission. I'm the Commissioner of the Nursing Commission and on the National Council of State Women's Nursing.
Mark Collier, and I represent subject installers, designers, and operation maintenance specialists. My background, years ago, I used to work here at the health department, and now I have a private septic design and land use consultant company.
Karen Evans, I'm retired, used to work for the county for many, many years, and worked with homeless programs and basic needs types of programs. So I'm representing the social service community.
My name is Greg Nolk. I represent a consumer of public health, and my daytime job is a physical therapist with Peace Health, and then I'm also heavily involved with the neighborhoods, Vancouver Neighborhood Alliance, and other aspects of community life such as that.
I'm Remy Houston. I'm a practicing pediatric dentist up in Salmon Creek. I represent the dental community in Clark County.
Lydia Gurman, Administrative Assistant for Clark County Public Health.
I'm Janice Koch. I'm with Public Health, and I am the Chief Performance Officer and now also supervising the HIV case management team.
Trevor Evers, Public Works Director for City of Washougal. I've been with Washougal 17 years. I'm representing public water purveyors and Clark County. been with the council since 2010. Thank you to everyone for the introductions. If you could just take a moment and look over the meeting notes dated October 20th, then we'll entertain a motion on those if there's no revisions or edits.
Motion to approve the minutes as written.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passes. We'll go ahead and move on to the nominations for 2016. I got correspondence from Joan, who's on the nomination committee. We also had a couple others that volunteered on that as well. So we have three nominations in total, one each for the chair, vice chair, and member at large. So the individuals that have been brought forward at this time are Mark Collier for the chair position, Stephanie Rose Yamashita for vice chair, and member at large, Adrienne Fairbanks. With that, we'll open it up if there's any other nominations for consideration or consider a motion.
Make a motion to approve or we vote.
You need a motion and a second.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
It took about 5 minutes. So.
Yeah. Now, 5 seconds ago, you said you weren't sure.
I don't know if you're sure about me.
So when the executive team met last week to prepare the agenda, there was interest in canceling the December meeting, but utilizing that date and time as a placeholder for orientation for new members, which is December 15th, which I think is a good opportunity just to get a better sense how the Public Health Advisory Council functions, and also just, I think, the county framework as far as delivering services. Any thoughts on that with canceling the December meeting? It's fairly routine for us to cancel the December meeting during the holidays and utilizing that for orientation for new members.
Good idea. Where's the held? Your orientation?
We're just going to have it in here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And actually, anybody who's interested in attending maybe wants a reorientation or something, you're certainly welcome to come. We're going to have dinner. That's our temptation.
Okay, we'll go ahead and move on the agenda. Next topic is the water utility position. As I've mentioned, I've represented water purveyors, public water purveyors in Clark County for about 5 years on the council. I took over for Mr. Prather, Steve Prather, who was with Clark Public Utilities as their water quality manager, and actually retired recently. So I've been looking and recruiting for an individual to represent water purveyors in Clark County starting in 2016. So I do have a couple of leads, a couple of individuals I think that would bring a lot of value to the council. The one individual that's expressed significant interest actually just moved on to Clark Public Utilities. He was a long-term employee with the City of Washougal, our water sewer manager, John Roth. He's well-versed in water system planning, emergency preparedness, water quality requirements, both Department of Health requirements as well as EPA, which are handed down from the feds, as you know. So I will be reaching out to him over the next several weeks. I did inform him that there's no formal meeting in December, but in offering up an opportunity for him or for the county counselor's consideration for an appointment to start in 2016. So I'll be following up with Alan and Lydia as well on that. Any questions on the water utility position? Okay.
Thanks for your service, Kevin.
That means a lot coming from my immediate supervisor. Appreciate that.
I'm not going to get a ride here anymore.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and move on to the director's report. Janice is going to be providing that on Dr. Melnick's behalf this evening.
Yes, so Dr. Melnick is at a conference. The first thing I wanted to talk about was the E. coli outbreak, and others from Public Health, if you want to add information, please feel free. So our staff visited two Chipotles in the Clark County area. They verified that all the fresh and frozen produce had been destroyed. They tested and assured that all the food contact surfaces had been thoroughly washed and rinsed and sanitized. They also revised and reviewed their food preparation processes to make sure that they were following best practice. We will continue to do our regular inspections there. There have been, there was 13 cases in Clark County, a total of 30 in the state of Washington, and 15 in Oregon, last count. Chipotle was very easy to work with. They were very proactive. They made sure that all the food that was in their restaurants was destroyed and thrown out. They did a lot of testing themselves. So they were very easy to work with. They were very responsive in closing the restaurants as soon as the outbreak was identified. So far in the statewide investigation, there's been no specific food item identified as the cause to the outbreak. They've also not been able to show that it had anything to do with food safety or how they were preparing foods. They've tested a lot. So far, they just haven't been able to identify what was the cause of the outbreak. And they said the three common reasons why we might get negative test results are it was a very small amount of contamination that caused the illness, or the contaminated food item was in a single batch and was consumed before the testing could be done, or that the surface that was tested had already been sanitized. So we probably, and I don't know, Leanne, how involved your team was in this, but I don't think we'll probably ever know what was actually the cause of the outbreak.
It's probably not a surface because it was at multiple locations.
Right.
Like on the border was at one location. So like you said, it's already consumed. That's some of the trouble. You can't, if one batch is already consumed and the new batch comes in and it's not contaminated, you can't locate. And it's really, really expensive to test. But I would highly doubt that it was a surface contamination problem. We've only seen it in one location,
yeah.
Not in locations across a region.
So, any questions about the outbreak? They're back open.
Yes, just to kind of understand how that works. So, there were multiple locations, but all at the Chipotle. And then they just get tracked back? You guys, it's just
so when people start getting sick with E. coli as a notifiable condition, then they do a whole investigation interview. Mm-hmm. And then when you do that, you start asking two-week food diary. And then once you start seeing that there's commonalities in that food diary, then it just kind of starts figuring out on its own that it was everybody ate at Chipotle during this incubation.
So each hospital does that interview process, and then once the E. coli gets reported? Yeah.
Once the E. coli is reported first, and then you do the interview with the person who's ill, and then you find that there's some kind of commonalities when you get more than one, mm-hmm. That all ate the same place, mm-hmm. and all within a certain incubation period window. And then from there, you can kind of get a hypothesis that it was there. And then there's ways, mechanisms to get it out to other jurisdictions, and you start finding out that other jurisdictions are having the same E. coli, and they Chipotle. You know, you start talking amongst each other, and you realize it's all coming from the same location.
And then it goes to a public health advisor that it kind of could be.
So Dr. Melnick, the health officer, will help guide the investigation. They kind of figure out between the, because these were multiple locations throughout different states, the State Department of Health got involved. Like back when the On the Border one happened with salmonella, same type of scenario, it was only one location, so it stayed within our jurisdiction in Allen. Dr. Melnick, you know, handled the whole investigation, but since this was multiple locations in multiple state, then state to state, EPIs worked, epidemiologists worked together to help figure out what's going on and work with local jurisdictions to make sure that they're getting all the information and working together to try to find out what happened.
So in terms of a reportable condition or disease, the lab or the providers will actually call us and say there's an E. coli case. Sometimes that leads to an outbreak.
Right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Sometimes it doesn't.
24/7.
Yeah. Sometimes it leads to something like this where it's an actual outbreak. Sometimes it could be a single case. Mm-hmm. But our public health nurses were even calling, in this case, people who ate at Chipotle and didn't get sick, just ask them, what did you guys eat? And trying to get a sense, but they didn't find any clear pattern between what was eaten.
Well, in Mexican food places are really hard because everything goes into everything. You know, it's not like it's steak and potatoes or chicken and potatoes. It's, you use a lot of the same ingredients in multiple meals, so it's really, really hard. Just like on the border, it was hard. Chipotle, both are really difficult because the lettuce is in almost everything. The tomatoes or salsa is in almost anything, so it makes it even harder to pinpoint in a like that, where like, you know, Asian cuisine, that they do a lot of the same foods.
And the distributors there didn't seem to have the same people who distributed food to the Chipotles didn't have the same distributors to the Taco Bell down the road.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Well,
but Chipotle does.
Big,
yeah, they make up just one.
And they do try to use.
They buy it in bulk, that it might be just out of a batch, I should say.
Okay. They try to use healthy, organic foods and the good and the bad of that, right?
Right.
It's not getting cooked, as much. So the other thing is, as many of you may be aware, we have a new Board of Health starting in January. The outcome of the elections starting in January, Mark Bolt will be the new chair, and Julie Olson will be another counselor. So we'll have five counselors. We had talked at a previous advisory council meeting about having a joint meeting with the Board of Health. So we wanted to, Mark has been on our Board of Health before. He is familiar with the work we do, and he's been very supportive, which is exciting. He at one point in time had a public health book club member with us, and he read quite a few books about that related to public health and came and met with staff and talked about the book. So he's a strong supporter. I don't know what Julie Olson's background is around public health, but we want to, I think we've talked about it and think it'd be good to treat Mark Bolt as if he hasn't been on the Board of Health before, just so he can get reoriented to what we're doing and any changes that have happened in our department. So wanted to check in with you guys about the possibility of having a joint Board of Health, Public Health Advisory Council meeting, and strategically, like, if you think there's a good time. Public Health Month is April, I think. So just one, thank you, Jeff. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it sounds good to me. I think you're going to be busy the first couple of months, trying to figure out what we're supposed to do. So
what we probably want to do, at least in January, is start talking about what is a priority, what strategically do we want to make sure that's at most on their mind, see where we are with the community health improvement planning, could be maybe something around ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences. So we'll put that on the agenda for January.
I was just going to say that. I think just the whole accreditation process would be useful to just review that. And
that's a great point.
Public health advisory. You guys are looking, you know, the department formal is looking ahead to be part of that, and then having just the Board of Health with the two new members kind of coagulating all of that.
Mm-hmm. That's a great idea.
Well, Janice, I know Julie Olson pretty well, and her public health knowledge is very limited. So
okay.
I hate to say it, but maybe the basics on up.
Okay.
So.
That's helpful. Thank you. Okay.
So we'll start planning that agenda, and we'll shoot now for April for Public Health Month. Okay. Just wanted to give you guys a head up. We are going to be applying for the marijuana tax grant. The trend recently with the Department of Health, DOH, is to not necessarily allocate these funds to local public health jurisdictions. It's been to look at, make the process more competitive. So we are not the only ones. And I believe with this one, we'll be applying with ESD, and ESD is the lead. Is this the one, Jeff, that's ESD is the lead on?
Yeah.
The funds, they wanted us to really target towards youth. And so this is going to be a really good opportunity for us to further strengthen those kind of partnerships, because the last thing we want to have in these kind of funding scenarios is to end up being competitors with our partners and creating tensions like that. So we're really excited about working with ESD on this grant process. Flu update. There's been no influenza activity in Clark County so far. Yay. I know, right? And I believe there's been basically no flu activity in the state. And 39 states have reported sporadic flu activity. And as we always say here at Public Health, the flu shot is still the best way to avoid getting the flu. Please get your shots. So that's all I had. Did any other questions about that or anything else you've heard going on?
Unusual data in mid-November.
Yep.
Yeah. It didn't arrive until March. It was very late.
And the match is for the vaccine, right? It's supposed to be pretty good this year, a pretty good match. That's all I had, unless there was something else.
Is there a cap or a threshold on the tax grant for marijuana as far as eligibility?
The portion for our county is $261,000. That's going to be a joint approach with the ESD of Lake Genesee. The first allotment is for 15 months. We're only planning on getting it for 15 months as of right now. So it's uncertain. We've heard rumors that this is the type of funding source that is easy to raid. Other parts of the state government can pull it away, I would say.
Seems like with all the tax money they're bringing in, there should be a lot more available.
I don't know.
I don't think the budget issues are quite settled yet, even though they actually passed the budget in June. I'm not sure if everything's settled around the school funding. So
there was a big commitment that was made to chemical dependency for adolescents around marijuana money that has not been fulfilled.
So yeah, there'll be a lot of pressure over those funds.
Yeah. Plus, Paul Davis left DOH, so that's going to be very interesting, a key person involved with that. Move to DBHR.
And what's DBHR?
Division of Behavioral Health and Recovery. Anyway, this is going to be interesting to see how it comes out, because Paul is pretty critical for that, but I think they're going forward.
For the first 15 months, yes.
What's the
tax?
What is the marijuana?
Well, marijuana was legalized, obviously.
Right.
It's heavily taxed.
Percentages on it?
It's
25%.
Yeah,
it's substantial. Yeah.
And they just cut it. Did they just cut it a little bit and then
try to equalize it?
And then down here we have the issue because people are just talking about marijuana like everything else, and it'll be cheaper there. So
It's not taxed at all. Well, not for a while, I didn't think, but I don't know what I'm
talking
about, really.
It's the same dilemma with medical marijuana and recreational marijuana.
Yeah.
So if they try to bring those two different markets into some kind of equilibrium, I do not believe the recreational market there is taxed.
Is the recreational market open? Yes, it is.
Yeah. And when, do you remember when that, when they're submitting that?
I believe it is due this month.
Okay.
I think the funding actually begins in January through March of 17.
So by at our January advisory council meeting, I mean, we should probably have some update on what's happened.
Yeah.
Great.
So I have a related but unrelated question. I don't know if right now would be the best time to ask it, but I figured just be quick. At our last neighborhoods meeting, you guys might have seen in the news about certain houses that have medical pot plants that are over the top and they're being harvested around the corner, and there's, you know, City of Vancouver's looking at nuisance ordinances. And, but we were talking about it in large group setting last week, and I just brought up the fact that maybe there's a public health, I don't know if there's a public health interest in that, but I thought I would just bring it to the leadership team and ask if you guys could kick that around and see if there's any legitimate public health interest that we could go back to the neighborhoods, because it's a big problem for the people that aren't dealing it, to deal with it. And
right.
So I don't know if there's any answers in there or not, but I thought just as a possible avenue towards a solution, if leadership could look at that, I would appreciate
it. Yeah, definitely, we'll talk about it. I think the challenge or the struggle that we have is that, and I don't know, Bob, you probably could talk about this from your perspective in Battleground, but sometimes these ordinances get passed and we really don't have the resources or the capability to do the regulating. I mean, we don't, to make sure that people are following the rules and the regulations. And I think, you know, like the Smoking Indoors in Public Places Act is a great example of how do we enforce that. And I don't know.
I know I'm familiar with it. I know that we put a moratorium on everything until we figure out how we're going to handle the, you know, the fencing around these collectives and all that, all those kinds of things. And I think there's just so many holes in all these things for us to even do any kind of enforcement. And then even if you want to do enforcement, the penalties are not worth your time with everything else you have to do. So, you know, I think we're still way down the road where we're going to figure out. We're all trying to figure out the same thing, the Sheriff's Department and who are us. How do we enforce these things? Whose job is it? Is it the police? Is it code enforcement? Is it the cannabis and liquor board or whatever they're called now?
Right.
And everybody's kind of looking at each other like nobody knows. So
it's just something that we need to tighten up legislatively? Is that really kind of what we're looking
for me
at?
Personally, I think that for our, the Board of Health, I think it would be a landmine to get involved in right now until it settles down, because there's so many different people that are involved in it. You know, there's the growers and there's distributors and there the people that sell retail, and you've got the medical marijuana side, you've got the recreational side, and you have all these competing interests. And even with this all going on, the federal government still is told that they just told Colorado, because Colorado was going to do their own banking system
right.
in the state, so these people would have a place to put their money. And the feds said, you're absolutely not going to do that. So on one hand, the feds are saying, oh yeah, we're not going to come after everybody. But on the other hand, they're saying, well, you're not gonna, you don't have any ability to finance this system or put this money that you're making somewhere lawfully. So to me personally, I think this is just my opinion. I think it's something, we've got a lot of other things to tackle. And you know, as far as when we're talking about zoning or you know, is marijuana visible or not, because the issues they're having now is odor. Your neighbor's smoking marijuana and it's floating over the fence
right.
in your backyard. Well, how do you control that? I mean, those are the kinds of things we're trying to figure out. And I don't think anybody knows the answers yet. So.
Well, we have a grow house across the street from where I live. And I had called to see what, as I thought it was 5 plants you could grow, but it's 15. And 15 plants, I mean, they're not like little plants.
Right. No,
they're like trees.
They're life size.
And they don't, they're not interfering with my family, but the people that are next door to them, which have 2 little kids, they can't have the kids in the backyard because these, you know, they're like trees.
Right.
And they've harvested now, and they had a pickup full of long cardboard boxes, so we figure they've got more grow lights and that it's right in a neighborhood.
Yeah,
and it's two blocks from elementary school and a middle school. And
it's
kids all over the place.
Well, then you still got people illegally growing it too, and still dealing.
Yeah. And we're, you know, we're all sitting around saying, hey, somebody making decisions elsewhere to go. I can tell you, just like, you know, if you drive down the street, Battleground, the big green sign everybody's complaining about says Cannabis Country Store. Well, if you look at the liquor board rules, that sign is illegal. But the liquor board says, well, those are just recommendations. We never codified them in RCW.
Is that
so,
what happened?
Yeah, so we step back and go, well, okay, have a nice day then. So, yeah, and I get it because they're under a lot of political pressure too. Everybody is, okay, what do we do? I don't know what the answer is. I think the answer is we all need to retire. But because, you know, to me, it's, hey, we used to throw people in prison. We used to put people in jail when I started for marijuana. Now it's just like, oh, it's just like no big deal. I mean, that's what people think. So it's just a different mindset we have to think. And for us, and what I tell my community, hey, my main goals now are you don't sell to minors. And believe it or not, the retail shops, especially in Battleground, are much more stringent. You can get in and sell, buy liquor a lot easier than you could buy marijuana in our city. And I'm driving under the influence. I mean, those are the two big things that we're focusing on. Because, you know, if they're going to legalize it and you can sell it out of a retail store, hey, at that point, you passed that law. I'm not concerned about that anymore. I'm concerned about if you're breaking the law or as far as selling to minors or if you're driving under the influence, and then we'll do drug DUI enforcement. And that's really kind of where we have to put our resources. I know it's not the perfect world because people call us all the time and say, hey, we don't like that store down there. I go, well, you know, did you go out and vote? Well, no. Well, you know how it is.
Okay. Okay to move on to the emergency preparedness from home. I think Leanne and Scott are going to give a quick overview of that.
Yes, so I'm Leanne from Public Health here, and I'm going to hand out this. First thing I want to talk about is our volunteer group that we run out of Public Health. And so we'll talk a little bit about that, as you guys are aware of it, and then we're going to talk a little about how we prepare our public health staff so that they're ready if they're at work, and then Scott will talk then about home preparedness. So I'll wait for these. So part of my job and preparedness is I run the Medical Reserve Corps, which is a volunteer group that is housed here at Clark County Public Health. But our unit, our preparedness unit, covers Clark, Skeene, Cowlitz, Wakayakum, and the Cowlitz Tribe. And so our MRC unit covers that whole area as well. If you can see on the front page here that we have 426 active MRC members in our region. And by active means that they have come and taken a 2.5-hour orientation course with us, where we talk about all aspects of public health and how we respond and what we would need from them. Tracy is one of our members. She's been a member from the very beginning, charter member, and has helped us a lot. And then once they do that, they have to take two online courses in incident command, which is how we handle disease investigations and outbreaks and things. Once they do that, they're considered an active member. And we don't have a minimum hours requirement or anything like that for our volunteers because we don't have public health emergencies regularly, thank gosh. But we want them to be affiliated with us. And I'll tell you more about that. So nationwide in the United States, there's almost 203,000 MRC volunteers. There's 997 units that house those volunteers. So it's about an average of 203 per unit. So we can see we're well above the average for volunteers in our region. The MRC started as part of Citizen Corps right after 9/11. During 9/11, there's a whole bunch of volunteers that wanted to go help, but they're not affiliated with anybody, so there was no way to know if they really had the licensure to be an RN or an MD or a veterinarian or whatever they were claiming. No one knew if that was true. They didn't have systems at the time, you know, to look it up to see if they were able to help. Didn't have a way to do background checks on site to see if they could go and help deal with kids or different things if they were going to be available. So the Citizen Corps was born And it's our citizen core group here in Clark County is housed out of CRESA. And it includes our MRC along with CERT and now volunteers from the Vancouver Police and now volunteers from Clark County Sheriff's Office, Search and Rescue, Fire Corps. They're all housed over there. We all work very, very well together in our county and we train together and do a lot of stuff. So the MRC was part of that group that came out of that. So that when we do have an emergency, we have people who are already license checked, background checked, and they can get on the ground and start helping people, while the next wave of what we call non-affiliated volunteers, spontaneous volunteers that just show up and want to help, can get background and license checked, and they can go on the next shift. So it's kind of a good way to get people in and out. There's a breakdown in the front here of how our volunteers break down. We have 10 doctors, 3 physician assistants, 11 nurse practitioners, 6 LPNs, 173 RNs, 57 nursing assistants, 3 certified medical assistants, a lab tech, 2 pharmacy techs, 10 paramedics, 5 social workers, 3 veterinarians, and then we have 142 that are in non-medical professions. And they're just as important to us as the medical professionals, and I'll tell you why in a second. We're just starting to beef up like our medical doctors, our veterinarians, and social workers. Those are the areas we really need to get more numbers in. We just got another vet that came on last week. She came through orientation. Because during shelters, and we have to house people and pets, and there's a big debate, do we house them together or not together? It's really nice to have some veterinarian techs to be there to help with any kind of problems with the animals, because people are not comfortable leaving their animals. So that's an area we're trying to beef up. And then if you turn it over, this is a little breakdown of how much these volunteers mean to us during a big event. So this is the H1N1 event back in 2009. So 6 years ago this month. It seems crazy that it's been that long. But from October 1st to December 1st of that year, we used 3,581 hours by 350 different volunteers. And our health department is 700 people. There's no way we could have done the response and gotten the vaccination to the amount of people that we needed to without the help of our volunteers. It was about an average of 10.25 hours per volunteer, which is equivalent of about 11.25 full-time employees. So they were a huge, huge help to us. You can see here, I broke it down by vaccinators, general support people, and call centers. You can see that there was a really good breakdown between Medical Reserve Corps volunteers, gave us 1,251 hours. Emergent volunteers, the people who just kind of showed up and asked to help, gave us 1,229 hours. And there are other Citizen Corps groups, the CERTs, the Red Cross, you know, the EOC volunteers, now volunteers, gave us 1,101, so they came in to assist us. So during H1N1, for example, where Cinetopia is now, we've had a big clinic up there where the old Mervyn's was. And on two Saturdays in November, we held huge clinics. And we needed 120 people per shift, and we had 2 shifts a day. And like I said, we have 75 people in our health department. There's no way we could have done that. 30 of them were medical and 90 were non-medical. So there's a big, big, huge amount of support that's needed to help us get through that very quickly. We had less than a 45-minute wait to get 1,200 people through the line when it first opened. Washington County, who doesn't use non-medical volunteers, had a 5.5-hour wait because their nurses have to do everything, all the paperwork and all the stuff, and it's really hard on them. So we're very, very grateful. So that's just a little overview of our Medical Reserve Corps that we run.
So this region is just the region is just Clark County, or is
it? No, it's the whole region four up there. So Clark, Skamania,
and what else?
Clark, Skamania, Wakaiakum, and Cowlitz, okay. And the Cowlitz tribe.
Okay.
And I actually responded to Lewis County during the floods.
2007?
Something like that.
Eight.
Something like that.
Eight.
And I was the only one to respond up there. They asked, and you know.
So you can sometimes respond.
I wasn't either the only one. There were others, but I just never saw them.
If other jurisdictions call, that's one thing about the MRCs. We have a state coordinator at the Department of Health, and if other jurisdictions need different volunteers, like during the wildland fires up in Ferry County, they asked for some nurses to come. During the 530 mudslides, they'd asked for some nurses. They were able to get them more locally than down here, but you know, they send it out and we would help assist if that's necessary, or the vice versa. So it's a really big, wide group.
Mm-hmm. So
is there any other questions?
I just wanted to add something.
Yeah.
That Leanne, just want to give her some kudos. She has done an amazing job with MRC. How many volunteers did we have in MRC when you took this over?
We had a little over 100.
Yeah, and now we have over 400. So
we had over 100 before H1N1, and we grew to about 250 right after H1N1 because we have a lot of spontaneous volunteers. And a lot of, we actually reached out through our provider advisories that you guys all, a lot of you guys get, that we send out. We said if anybody wanted, you know, we have medical volunteers that are willing to help, call, and because we were needing volunteers to run these clinics. And a lot of those people then signed on to become volunteers. And then we just said, Veronica, and I do very little outreach. I don't do any outreach. It's a lot of word of mouth, people telling other people about it. I work closely with Clark's Nursing School, and they get some, they have to do a lot of volunteer service hours, and so we do it with them. So they part of the orientation, doing their instant fan class count as their volunteer hours, and a lot of them stay on them as they get their medical license. Any other questions about the Mercy? So then the other thing I'm going to talk about really quick is how we prepare our staff. Since public health staff is considered first responders, we need to make sure that our staff is prepared. If something happened in our building, that our staff would be okay here and can sustain themselves here for a few days if we had to. And then Scott will take over and talk about preparing yourselves at home in case a disaster happens while you're at home, and we need you to still come back to your room. The bottom line is you're going to be here, so we need to get it right. So when Dr. Eastman, now I guess I should say, was here as our director, he was a very big proponent of preparedness. And so he had our staff do, well, first of all, what they did is they bought these kits here. So every desk in our office has this little kit, and it has this magnet that goes on the outside of the drawer that people put it in. So if it's dark and people are looking for something, they'll know what drawer to go to look for supplies. And through preparedness money that they got, they bought these little kits, these little lunch boxes, and in here they have things like these delicious that you will need a lot more than just water to get down. But it has water, this food box in there, which will get you by if that's all you have. And these are the only two things in here that are perishable. And these are good for 5 years, and these are good for 8,000 years. and they will still be thirsty in 8,000 years from
now. Is there any E. coli in there?
No. They can't grow in this brick.
There's nothing natural there to allow
that to grow. Yeah. Maybe he's in the military. I just pray. So then there's a little hazmat strip if you have to do a chemical test. There's an emergency blanket, a shake flashlight, a first aid kit, a whistle, and some tissue. And then we encourage our staff to add their own things in here, snacks or different comfort foods or things they might want during an emergency. And we have these at all the desks, and then we rotate the water and food as it expires. We'll buy new ones and go to each person bring us theirs and return it. And so we have these at each desk so that if we do get stuck in our building, that we can still do work and help our public, but we'd be able to be taken care of. There's a lot of businesses who don't have something like this, and we really encourage them. So I went out and did a personal awareness talk at Nautilus, and as I was talking to them, they're like, oh, we were stuck here. They don't know food service in their building, nothing. You know, like here we have some food service for residential downstairs. The hospitals obviously have a lot of food service. But just think about where you work. If you were stuck in your building, would you be able to survive for a couple of days? And so we've done a really good job of trying to get that ready for us here. Then the other thing that John did when he was here is he got us involved with the John Hopkins Public Health Infrastructure Response Survey they did. And so what we did is each of our employees take a survey about whether or not, how comfortable they would feel responding during a biological or a radiological device dispersal, and how knowledgeable they were on the effects of those things, and if we were asking them to come back into work to help respond, how comfortable they would be. Are they prepared at home? Could they leave their families to come in? And so they took a survey, and we got the results from the survey, and then we sent them through these steps. And the first step was we had a facilitated led discussion that me and Nathan Wade, who now's at DOH, and our partner Rich,
did with all of our employees and had a discussion about biologicals and radiological device disbursements and dirty bombs and anthrax and all those scary things that people don't want to think about, and talked about how, what the plume would look like and how sick people would be and what our response would look like. And then we sent them through a series of tasks they had to go home and do. So they got 3 hours of work paid time to build a kit, which Scott will talk to you about, to map out three different ways to get to and from work. And they had to bring in the maps. They had to take a picture of themselves with their kit so that they couldn't use someone else's kid's picture. And map out three ways to get to and from work. And then they had to do a couple of online little presentation things. And then after they did all that, and we did the facilitated-led discussions, then we went back and we did another face-to-face talk with them about more in depth about what we would do to prepare and how we need to get ready and what kind of responses we would do with. And then we did a post-survey, and it was almost a 70% increase in participation that people would come back to work than the first time, just from the knowledge that they got from us doing the facilitated discussions and actually understanding what they would be up against. So we're looking at doing this again because we've had turnover and it's been 5 years, so that people can relook at their kits, relook at their ways to work. People might have moved, you know, and hope the new people can get on board with that so that they're aware. Just like during H1N1, when we first asked staff to come and work in our pods, you know, our points of dispensing to give vaccine, a lot of them were really, really nervous. They didn't, you know, I don't know what to do. But once they got there and did it once, they were signing up again for the next ones because they thought it, I mean, it was well organized. They knew what to expect. So we're trying to do that with emergency so that people, we ask them to come back into work to help us, that they're comfortable to come back in and help us. Is there any questions before Scott talks about personal preparedness?
Thank you. So, Scott Johnson, I'm the Emergency Management Division Manager at Cresa. How many of you knew that we have an Emergency Management Division at Cresa? Yay, my PIO is doing his job. All right. Clark County, we have what's called Consolidated Emergency Management. Washington Administrative Code requires every jurisdiction in the state to have an Emergency Management Department. We have one. So I am the emergency manager for the county as a jurisdiction, the city of Kashubel, Camas, Battleground, the center sometimes, Richfield. So I'm your emergency manager. Our division is your emergency management division. We have 24/7 duty officer coverage. In fact, right now, don't drive home on Mill Plain between 164th and 192nd.
It's closed.
It's
flooded.
Closed.
Wow.
Flooded. Wow. So if you weren't here, you could find that out by going online and registering to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We have a nationally recognized social media campaign. Because public alert, warning, public education is probably the most effective way to prepare for a disaster. Okay? Disasters, emergencies, they all start at the individual level. Regardless of the size or scope of the emergency, like Leanne mentioned, I spent 22 years in the military. I have responded to 2 global humanitarian disasters. I've responded to 3 presidential disasters. And I responded to 7 gubernatorial disasters. And the common thing about every one of those is that resilience starts at the individual level. When something bad happens, as a human being, you're going to do 3 things, and you're going to do them in this order. First thing you're going to do is you're going to make sure that you're okay. If you're leaking people juice, you're not able to help. Second thing you're going to do is you're going to make sure those immediately around you are okay, especially if you're at home, especially if you have 4-legged companions. Because if they're leaking people juice or furry juice, you're not going to help. Then you can go outside and you can make sure the people around you, your immediate neighborhood, is okay. Once those 3 things are good, then you can get into the fight. Then you can go back to work. Then you can help out. And that's not a matter of professionalism. It's not a matter of dedication. It's a basic human response. I knew New Orleans police officers, some of the most dedicated professionals that I've worked with, that were not able to help their community because their families were flooded, because their neighborhoods were flooded. So it's not a matter of dedication. It's a matter of, those are three basic human responses. So, how do you make sure those things are in place so when you make sure you're okay, your immediate family is okay, people around you are okay, and your neighborhood's okay? Starts with you and personal preparedness. Alright, like Leanne said, she has a kid at work. How many of you have a kid at home? Let's start at home. Great. You got 5 days minimum food, water per person, right? 5 days.
I mean,
you got 5 days of medication. And you got 5 days of pet medication. Pets as a food source is considered suboptimal. Okay. How many of you live or have somebody in your neighborhood that has special needs? Dialysis. Okay. Do you have emergency backup power to take care of that? Okay. If you do, great. If not, you may want to get to know your neighbors. Because remember, after I make sure you're okay, you go outside. One of the big things that we advocate is something called Map Your Neighborhood. Now, I don't run it because I don't want to know what 440,000 people are doing in their neighborhoods. But I do know that the woman who lives across the street is a licensed construction electrician, so when lines go down, she can de-energize them. I know that the couple on the other end of the block has every tool in the Home Depot catalog. And I know the guy on the other end of the corner is on dialysis. So I know who my neighbors are. And that becomes important because when large scale or even moderate disasters happen and you become isolated by water flooding, by snow, winter, you become what's called a micro island. And the micro island is your little community. Now, if I had to pick a micro island, I'd probably pick the one that's up on 117th where you've got a Fred Meyer's, a Lowe's hardware store, a liquor store, and a gas station. But we can't always choose where we're going to be when a disaster happens, so you need to make sure that you know what type of resilience you have within your micro island. So at home, talk to your neighbors. Know what their needs are, know what their capabilities are. Understand that these are the people, especially in a large-scale disaster, that you're going to be relying on for quite some time. 5 days is a minimum. Okay? 5 days is a minimum. If you live in some of the more rural parts of the county, you're probably looking at 7 to 10. And that's because of the geology of our county. We have a lot of bridges and overpasses. We have a lot of areas that are prone to isolation. How many of you have 48 hours worth of resilience in your primary mode of transportation and know if you ride a bus, bumming off your fellow bus riser isn't resilience? Okay, you can't answer this.
What does that mean, the transportation, 48 hours of resilience of transportation?
In your car.
So you could say you could get that in your
car. If you got stuck in your car, okay, there's about 125 vehicles stranded in California on the El Cajon Pass right now. They're working to get those people out. Some of them are probably going to be in their car for at least another 24 hours. So, how many of you have 48 hours of resilience, food, water, in your car?
When I lived in North Dakota, I totally did.
See, now,
and
I get that response a lot. When I lived in North Dakota, I did. When I lived in Florida, I did. When I lived in Alaska, I did. We are blessed in where we are at geographically that we don't have that. But that also leads to the curse of complacency. How many of you have 5 days of resilience at work? Okay. All right. Work, it becomes even more important. Because you already have the anxiety that you may be separated from your family. How many of you got family members at work on the other side of the river? Okay. So in large isolation events, you're adding to that anxiety. Have a level of preparedness at work. And you can also map your work neighborhood. Like Leanne mentioned,
She knows where there's food. She knows which kind of resilience and strength they have next door at the VA, that they have at Clark College, that they have at the 7-Eleven three blocks that way.
Not that you would know. Every 7-Eleven there is anywhere.
Notice how there hasn't been an E. coli breakout at the 7-Eleven. Exactly. Exactly. It's not the natural material for the bacteria. So, know your neighborhood. Know what that type of resilience is, especially at work, okay? Because that becomes important. Now, the information I passed out has some of those key things on how you can start building your preparedness and your kid at home. When you start looking at this, and this is just a guideline, preparedness, we get asked a lot, how prepared are we? And I always tell people, when we get done talking, you'll be better prepared than you were when we started this conversation, but nowhere near as prepared as we need to be. It's one of those ongoing things, okay? The information that was passed out has a great place to start. But when you start looking at it, it can often be overwhelming. So the couple things you can do to scale down that sense of overwhelming. One, the little white trifold talks about doing it weekly. Just a 24-week thing. Do these things a week. That's a good way to prepare for it.
And if it's still overwhelming, you do it week by week, though, month by month. Mm-hmm. That's what we tell people when we go to the outreach.
30 days, 30 ways.
Do it, you know, month by month and at least start. Yeah. If you can't, if it's still overwhelming week by week, but it is sometimes financially and just emotionally overwhelming for people.
So. Start with your car key. Take a 1 gallon bag, put in some water, throw in some granola bars, throw in some hand warmers, and you've just created 24 hours of resilience in your vehicle. It's a place to start.
These work also really well in your car. Sorry, I'm picking it here. Because they're pretty resilient to heat and to cold, and they fit well in your glove box or something, and you can pick them up at Walmart, Fred Meyer, REI, anywhere. And they're really not that expensive. I mean, we bought some for the apartment here. It was, I think, $25 for 30 of them or something. And they're pretty inexpensive. But they're nice because it's 4 ounces of water, and this could get you, you know, through your car for a while. And they're easy to store, and they're you know, you can't really puncture them very easily, and they do stay good in the heat and cold, which temperatures vary your car so often.
Can you open them?
There's just a tear, a notch in them, so you don't have to, you know, they are pretty easy to open.
When you buy it and try it, if you can't, put a pair of scissors in your kit.
Yeah.
Get a big pair of trauma shears.
Yeah, the ones that don't poke you and stuff. But so, those are easy for your car.
Bad thing happens, people want to know. Make sure that you have an out-of-area point of contact, okay? Little green card. Talk to your family members. Fill it out. Identify somebody out of the area, okay? Newsflash, if you live in Vancouver, despite what you think, Battleground is not out of the area.
And neither is San Francisco. It's also out of the same disaster zone.
Yeah, try to get somebody, like, at least, I don't know, Kansas or East. Okay? If you don't know anybody, go onto Facebook and say, hey, you want to be my disaster buddy? You'll get some weirdos, but you'll get somebody that you can communicate with. All right? So, little blue booklet comes out from a combination of State Department of Health, Military Department, State Department of Emergency Management. Got lots of good information. How many of you got a water heater in your house? Okay, how many of you know you got at least 35 gallons of clean, potable emergency water? That's why I said the water. How many of y'all know how to get the water out of it? See, good. You guys are already, you know, better than half the people we talked to. Okay? So, some foundations to start building that individual preparedness at home. There's plenty of websites you can go on to. Okay? Red Cross has some, ready.gov. In the back of the blue pamphlet provided by the state, there's a whole bunch of them.
And then also on page 11 in that booklet, which is my favorite part of this booklet, is a table that tells you how much bleach to use per gallon of water. Because I'll guarantee you, when you have to use bleach to get your water pure enough to drink, you're going to go to Google it, and you'll have no power, and you won't know. Because I talk about this all the time, and I couldn't tell you. So even if you have to rip that page out, you know, put it inside your kitchen cupboard, whatever, these books are really nice because they're small enough, they go into like a junk drawer somewhere in your kitchen with your cookbooks. But page 11 has got the information that most of these other pamphlets don't have, which is the bleach to water content.
Leech is not a flavor to taste.
No. So. Don't use the flour.
Yeah, use smell, fresh regular 3.5 chlorine. Mm-hmm. Do not use the stuff with fabric softener. Yeah. Do not use the stuff that's lemon scented.
Or flour scented, bring it up.
Yeah. So, what questions do you have?
So, do you guys?
I've got an environmental health background, and I brought something on water disinfection too.
Okay.
Some charts. Some pass around.
Oh, great.
Pretty much the same as. Okay.
So, Leanne brought up the reason that you want to have an out-of-area contact. You're probably going to have a lot of people overloading lines or maybe some lines down, sometimes getting out long distance. Also, in a large-scale disaster, text rather than calling takes up less bandwidth. Okay. Send a brief text to a central point of contact. I'm okay. Everybody else can then check in with that person. So it has that benefit. If you can, get that person additional copies of your key documents, stuff that's irreplaceable. If you can, get it scanned onto a thumb drive and have a thumb drive sent there. So, and these are, like I said, these tips and a lot more than we could cover in this meeting are in some of these documents. And some of these other websites. So what are some just general disaster individual readiness preparedness questions, comments, concerns? How many of y'all been watching OPB and are now looking at property somewhere in the east?
Walla Walla.
Yeah, Walla Walla. Yeah, bomb shelter.
So I'm curious, Alden, I don't know if you could talk about this, but in terms of the hospitals, how do you guys prepare for these kind of big disasters?
We have emergency preparedness drills that we do. It's required at least once a year. We do it four times a year at our hospital. There are commonly multi-organizational drills that take place, and they will be run by disaster management folks. There are state drills that take place on a regular basis. Are we as prepared as we would like to be? No. Many of us have gone to Aniston, Alabama, and done the training that they have for disaster preparedness there. All of us that are in the various roles have been through that training. And so we sort of have a feeling that we can get through a disaster a whole lot better than 5 days in Memorial did after Hurricane Katrina down in New Orleans. If you've not read that book, I very much encourage you to read it because it tells you good reasons for why you ought to prepare and practice. It's a very good read, but the hospitals do a lot to prepare. Are we prepared? No, we're not. But we can probably get through it because we've had some preparedness. Mm-hmm.
ODOT is fixed to close I-85 East from Troutdale to Cascade Lockins due to high rain, high wind, and treated
rain. High 84.
That's what I said.
85.
Like 85.
Where's
84? 84.
84. What are those 80s?
At least y'all were paying attention.
Wow.
So, that white piece of paper, first, the little thin one. Okay. That not only allows you to follow us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, but there's some information on one of the more important things that we do. How many of y'all have heard of something called reverse 911? Okay, don't call it that because that's a trademark product and a lawyer sends nasty grams. We have an emergency community notification system that allows us when law enforcement, fire, EMS wants to send a large public message. Hey, something bad's happened, y'all need to leave. Hey, something bad's happening, y'all need to stay. Hey, could you help us look for somebody? It's called ECNS. If you have a landline telephone, your number's already provided. Hold on a second. How many of you have a landline phone? How many of you got Comcast bundle? You don't have a landline phone. You have something called a voice over internet protocol. You have an internet phone line. It's not a landline.
Sounds expensive.
Huh?
Sounds expensive.
Yeah,
it is.
So if you have a Comcast bundle or if your cell phone is your primary phone, you need to actually go on and register your number. What that does, register for it, put that down as your primary address. You can list multiple addresses. You can go on, register, so you can register your phone number for your work address, go back on, register your home number, so that when we go into that program to launch an emergency community alert and we draw a geographic circle around the map point, every number that's registered to an address within there pops up and they get the message. So that would be the biggest, most important reason to take that one and register your phone number.
And it comes through as a voicemail?
So what you're going to get, you can get a text and you're going to get a phone call. Okay, it's going to ring three times and a voice is going to say, this is an emergency message from the Clark Regional Emergency Service Agency and the Vancouver Police Department. Please do not hang up. Vancouver Police Department has asked us to be the lookout for a 15-year-old male who has autism who was last seen in your neighborhood. He is 15 years old. He is approximately 5 feet 7 inches tall, blonde hair, last seen, and I know this because this is the one that we launched on Sunday night at 2 o'clock in the morning. Okay, they found him about 3 hours later. He was fine. So, it's not always bad things. In fact, oftentimes we get people calling in to tell us that they have seen missing people. So, register your phone.
Is it a similar system to what the universities use? Because I knew that for
WSUB, they'll do this. WSUB uses a very, very similar one. They use a product called Everbridge, which is what I want for Christmas.
This is Paul City Talk.
Yes, they have a learning system that has several layers of features that allows for vulnerable population identification analysis, plume cloud modeling, evacuation route planning, and it would allow us to really identify some of our community members that we want to prioritize possibly or assist if they have mobility issues if we had to do a large-scale evacuation. So, and they have that one tied in through their main campus of enrollment. So our system is a regional system. It supports, I can actually launch messages into Skamania and Tioga County. They can launch messages here. So we do have a region-wide system.
I had a question about someone on the team, the West Yugle team, was mentioning that even if you're not subscribing with a landline provider, if you have an old landline phone and you have landline wiring in your house and you plug that phone in and dial 911, so this is to get in, not to get, mm-hmm. it will go.
It's a true statement.
Okay. Because mm-hmm. I know one of the reasons you hear for people, like, we are wireless, mm-hmm. we just did the double button.
Yeah.
Was that's more important than not even registered. So
yes.
We have those things laying around. I didn't know what to do with them.
Keep one. Plug it in because they also work during power outages.
To get to 911.
Yes. Now, 911. Okay, which is going to be my next topic. We have two emergency notification numbers that ring. Thankfully, not in my office. They ring about 30 feet down the hall from where I'm at. One of them is 911. You're all familiar with that. We have a new one that was rolled out around the 1st September, 6th September, and it's 311, non-emergency law enforcement. So, what does that mean? You wake up in the morning, you look outside, and your car is gone. 311. You wake up in the morning, look out the window, and you see your car driving away. 911. Okay? You look out the window and you see your neighbor walking up and down the street waving a nasty machete. 911. Unless it's in battle. Then it's Friday night. Yeah. That's also just law enforcement. Okay? Fire, medical, still 911. They're answered by the same people in the same location, so don't waste time trying to figure out which one to call. If you call 3 and it should have been 9, they're still going to handle it. It should have been 9.
Error on the side of 911.
Yeah.
As much education as we're trying to get out, we had our guy call 311, be put on hold for 7 minutes because we were busy, to find out his wife is on the floor in back pain and can't move. So they're still, you know, not calling the appropriate number, and sites are likely to be put on hold or on an extended hold with 311.
So if in doubt, call 9, but if you know it's not an emergency and it's law enforcement.
Totally.
Okay. Other things that aren't non-emergency law enforcement. I've been stuck in the drive-in at Burger King for 15 minutes. Goodwill would not take my donation. What was the other one that we got? Yeah, so just because you're having a bad day, some of you specialize in that. So, all right, what other questions you got?
Does Chief get to count the 311 calls?
Do I get to count them?
I, you know, Ron gives us his data. It's just a, it was a bad,
oh, yeah.
It was,
well,
a bad joke.
It kind of depends if you, what you're trying to prove.
Will it make my case or not?
Yeah, well, it depends.
Yeah,
so do you do any evaluations for businesses? I mean, I'm just thinking more about the kind of the, because we treat kids, we have an inpatient community of about 16 adolescents, and I've oftentimes wondered, what would we do if we were stuck there for 3 days? What would we do if the food delivery couldn't make it across the interstate bridge?
Right.
I think about that all the time.
You need those bars.
Yeah.
They'll hate you forever.
Yeah. 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 Order a couple of pizzas.
Or you get Domino's over here. Steph.
Jimmy John's.
So, when the first thing you can do is go online to FEMA.gov, go into the independent study program and take a course called IS-100, okay? Do not take the course prior to operating heavy machinery or driving. Do not take the course if there are sharp pointy objects that you will drive in your eyes. However, it's a good course. It's the introduction to the incident management system. So it's what uniform responders, non-uniform responders, and emergency managers use when we respond to an incident. What it does, it kind of gets you to understand how the process works and is organized. And then once you start taking that, you go back to your organization and you say, okay, when the bad thing happens, here's the first thing that we're gonna do, all right? When you start looking at all this stuff and you start thinking about it, you're like, my God, this is like trying to boil the ocean. Okay? Y'all know how you boil the ocean?
One
gallon at a time. So that's why I said take a 1 gallon bag, put your water and your granola bars in it, put it in your car, and you're that much closer to having your personal level of resilience. So you thought I just made up that 1 gallon thing, right? It's all zen and tied in. All right, no more questions?
Well, I just had one, just from a regional perspective, just for, you know, the aggregate of the counties, the cities, hospitals, what are the gaps in our system? Where is still the room for improvement that we can be aware of?
So this is gonna sound like I'm fudging on this question, but we have gaps all across our community. And that's why we work with all of our partners to close the gaps, to identify which gaps we can close with individual community engagement, which gaps are more our, you know, governmental responsibility. Public education and public awareness is probably our biggest single gap. Having people understand that, I have a very dedicated staff. I have a staff of 6 people that will do anything, but they cannot make 440,000 individual disaster preparedness plans. 440,000 people making individual disaster preparedness plans can create a level of resilience that will get our community through virtually. So having people understand that taking care of their own resilience and preparedness, starting with themselves, to the greatest extent they can. If you can do 7 days, do 7. If you can only do 3 because you live in a small apartment in downtown Vancouver, do 3. You live on a farm halfway out to Amboy and you can do a month, do a month. Do the greatest extent of personal preparedness and resilience that you can. that's probably the biggest gap that we have.
That, and I also add that over population is a big gap. In our preparedness unit, we used to have 10 people working in preparedness unit, and we have 3 now in an office assistant. And we used to have somebody who was just dedicated to vulnerable populations and outreach to them and getting them information on being prepared and stuff, and we don't have the resources anymore to get out to the vulnerable populations and to the long-term care facilities and into assisted living homes and that kind of thing, and making sure they're prepared and that they can sustain themselves if needed. We just don't have resources, so that's a huge gap. It's a funding gap for resources to get out to the public and do talks. And, you know, like some of the businesses will call and ask us to come in and do talks, and we do, you know, but we can't just, you know, we don't have the staff to go and solicit, oh, give us a call, we'll come out. But if they call, we go out. But it's tough when there's only a few people, like between Crest and us. Sometimes we'll go together, or sometimes we'll, okay, you'll go this day and I'll go this day because they have 2 days they want to do. And we try to work together a lot because we get a lot of the same information out. But part of the gap is resources to get out to those.
And we do as many fairs as we can. The responders have fairs, safety fairs throughout the year. And
a lot of them just see the same people there. Yeah. You know, we don't see the people. It's people who want to come to those things. We got to get people who don't want to come to those things. And that's I think that's a huge struggle, is getting out to people instead of people coming to us.
And it's not as easy as social media anymore. Sorry, Cynthia.
No, it's okay.
It's not as easy as social media anymore. I went to a neighborhood association meeting the other day, and we were talking about how to communicate within the association. And they had established a Facebook page. And I said, well, why don't we just post on Facebook when we have problems in the neighborhood? And they asked for a raise of hand on how many people actually use Facebook. And there was like 5 in the whole room of probably about 40. And so they found out that they communicate primarily by email. So that's the mechanism they set up in that Neighborhood Watch Association to communicate. They're not on Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. So
yeah, and I've seen in our neighborhood, we have a sheriff deputy in our neighborhood, and he set up a text circuit through our email and texting that he set up for that emergency. But if you don't have somebody who's familiar with that in your neighborhood, it's tough, you know, and trying to get out and teaching people about, well, Scott was talking about map your neighborhood and learning about each other and helping each other out is what's going to have to happen. It's just resources, you know, it's getting out there.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things that came to mind. One is, if you talked about ICS, but incident command systems, if you've never had the training, get the training. Because in school disasters, the quote that I always remember from Columbine was the superintendent, I think, said, it's not that we had a bad relationship with law enforcement, it's that we had no relationship. Mm-hmm. So if you're in a big organization and you don't understand incident command systems, it's going to be awful for you. Because when they come in, they take over. Anyway, I'm just talking about it from a school's perspective, but there's a lot of lessons learned around just understanding that system is really good, and it is really boring, but it's important to have. And then
you'll learn to love it. You will learn to.
No. Yeah, I don't know. We're gonna, anyway,
Janice's note.
It's easy to access. It's online, so it's really easy to get to and access, and you can actually go away and come back.
But I know, like, when we had our active shooter here in our building, mm-hmm. you know. When the officers showed up, a lot of us from the club were able to fall right in and help
right.
them
mm-hmm.
because we knew exactly their chain of command and how it was going to work and what they had to do, because we had a relationship, you know, because I knew a whole bunch of them were there. I was able to go and show them our building, know where to go, but we know the system because we use the same system, and it does help a lot to have those relationships, and it makes things a lot less chaotic when, especially if you had an officer that goes in a building and sees a familiar face. You know, it helps them just as much to see someone familiar as it feels for you to see somebody familiar on the other way, because they know somebody who knows the building and they can trust. And so those relationships are crucial during times of emergencies. And just like when, you know, we had the, you know, a unified response with Peace Health and, you know, with Dr. Roberts' agency, and they know incident command, and they're learning more and more now since we went through it with them, but it helped us work together and respond better because they were familiar with the same system that we use. Even though we do 2 totally different things, it helped it mesh better and get the services out that they needed out because they understood the same system that we understood.
It does work. I responded to Roseburg, to the shooting down there, and I responded to the group that not everyone knows ICS, and it was not fun that way.
It's chaotic.
it wasn't for me, because having been MRC and responding to some of the things that I have, you know, with everything that I do, I know how to take care of myself. And I know when I'm in danger, I get out of it. And, you know, if I don't have backup, too bad, because my primary responsibility in an emergency is to take care of me first, like you said. First, mm-hmm. I check me.
So do we do it, do you learn it at the same place, FEMA.gov, and that's just the...
Yeah, FEMA.gov.
IS-100.
100 and 700 are the two introductory classes that we ask our volunteers to take. Those are the two basic courses that would be good to start with. And if you get entry, 200 is another one which talks about resource allocations and stuff like that, which are some of the things that, as any kind of business owner or anybody working in any kind of industry, you know, you might be asked for resources or to help out with resources and things through the emergency support functions at the EOC. But those three courses are the ones you can take online, and there's a whole bunch of other, you know, all kinds of different things, but those are the three, 100, 200, 200 and 700. And then it gets more in depth as responders into in person classrooms. 300.
Yeah, those are the online classes.
Yeah.
They serve their purpose. I'm not going to pretend that they're educational, entertaining, but they are informative.
They're driving. But yeah. Once you've gone through them, even if you don't think it's all sunk in, if you get put in a situation, you're gonna like, oh yeah, I saw that before. Oh yeah, I saw that before.
We actually have all of our employees. Mm-hmm. That we hire go through those courses.
Ours are, it's mandatory for public health to take any staff to take 100.
And it's not really a foreign concept. Most of you have been an incident commander at some point in your life, you just didn't realize it.
Yeah. It's required. Yeah.
If you're used to being in charge in an agency, mm-hmm. and then something happens and incident command comes in and they take over, it can be worth the time to learn about what's going to happen. You know,
right.
They're in charge,
right.
And you're not.
And they can take control pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's, anyway.
Yeah, it helps to know. It helps to have.
But it also helps you figure out where you fit in
right.
the structure.
Right.
Because you do fit in. It's just where you fit in, and knowing where you fit in and where how the chain of command goes, so that you only take direction from one person and you only feed information to one person to keep the hectic chaos, mm-hmm. you know, down to a minimum as much as you can.
So Greg, did that answer your question?
It's created more.
There is also, so you folks know, there's one other thing that's going to be, you're going to be hearing about around the first of the year. We were authorized by our admin board to purchase a software program called Smart 911, and it is actually a database, online database, where the vulnerable population and people can go in and log information about themselves in. Anything about themselves, photos about themselves, house plans, autistic children, anything like that, and up to five phones, cell phones. And when those phones ring into 911, that information is actually presented to the 911 dispatcher and can also be presented to the responders, so they're aware of it.
How cool is that?
It is great. The other thing that's really nice about that, we've never been able to do that in the past because we just haven't had the staffing to maintain something like that. The nice thing about this program is it is maintained by the company. They actually go out and ping the individuals every 6 months to verify or update the information. And if they don't verify or update that information, they don't present it to 911. So the information has been reviewed and verified within the last 6 months. And there's been multiple life-saving events for people that can't talk, that can't, you know, that are on machines, that have power problems, things like that. It's a pretty swift program. It's called Smart 911. If you're interested, I'll just go on Google and Google it. You can see all about it.
So that's for people who have medical needs?
That's for anybody. I mean, you can... I actually have a profile. You go in and put a profile in, and wherever you go in the United States, any agency that has invested in Smart 911 will have that information presented if you call 911.
So if you call, they have your phone number.
They have my phone number. They have
all your profile of just
right.
age and your what?
Pictures of my kids.
Whatever.
Oh, your animals, whatever. So imagine if you have a missing autistic child and
right.
the law enforcement needs it and they have the photo of the child immediately right in front of them without having to respond to your house, find the photo and then distribute it to all the other law enforcement. So
it seems like everybody should do that.
Yes.
gate codes, anything.
If I could get 440,000 people to sign up for it, that would be Christmas.
So there's not like a, I mean, it's not, it's just for everything. Why isn't that more full size?
Because it's not cheap. It's going to cost us about $25,000 a year to maintain that. The 911 agency is the one that is that has to pay for it. The citizens, it's free for citizens to log in and sign up. It's well worth it, I think, in the long run, when you have to start seeing some of the saves that is done across the United States. So yeah, getting the information out is going to be.
That's not a federal thing. That's not.
It's, no, it's
I
a
was
federal
in a training
no,
class
a thing.
At FEMA, at, well, emergency the. Emergency Management Institute, and one of the guys in our class was a fire, he's a fire chief out in Virginia, and they have something similar. What they're trying to get in there for the responder safety too is people have hoarding, you know, issues and stuff like that, so that there's more safety precautions going in there. But he has the same, they're trying to get the same thing on board for that and for the photos and for medications is another big one too, not knowing the medications are on the paramedics going in and to have that in there.
Whatever you
it's
would
huge.
Want a law enforcement officer to know. I have a friend who has several large dogs. They're friendly if they know you. And she is waiting for that because she's going to put that on there. So that when responders respond, they're aware of that. It's whatever you would want somebody who is responding to know. It doesn't have to be...
chronic health condition, it could be dialysis, it could be Alzheimer's,
yes.
It could be...
The only word of caution that we're going to try to put out when we start educating people is, obviously, you want to look at all of this stuff, but in the reality of 911 calls coming in or responders responding out, there's going to be times that you're not even going to have time to even look at that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have probably a several-pronged approach. You know, our call taker that takes the call, we're going to try to get them to have the time to look at it. They've got the dispatcher at that point that hopefully will have time to look at it.
They have your favorite color.
And we have the responders that hopefully can access it right from their mobile devices.
And that's all secured, obviously, information.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Matter of fact, the reason that we had actually waited to roll it out is because in May, they just passed what they call the Sunset Bill in the legislation that protected all that information from public records.
And it's called SOP 911.
Smart.
Sign information is protected.
Protected from public records access.
So if anybody has follow-up questions for you or is... Yeah, I mean.
So Scott's email is ANNA.
I mean, it's Scott. It's if somebody has further questions or is hoping that you can refer them to someone that can help their agency get something set up, is
yes.
that appropriate?
I would be the primary point of contact.
Okay, and then Leanne also, you guys can do that. But also, if anybody's interested in MRC. They can contact you. Okay. So if anybody wants that contact information, you can email Lydia and she can distribute it so we don't have to try to write it all down there. Huh?
She put our emails in the email.
Okay.
And you can find it on those handouts,
yeah,
the food website.
Well, see, I was looking through there. I didn't see
Scott
Johnson. I'm just saying.
That was intentional.
I was looking for his home number.
I can give you his home address.
Thank you.
I'll find him at 7-Eleven every morning around 6:30
a.m. Again, they haven't had the coli outbreak. I haven't had the flu in 47 years, and I don't give a shot because there's enough chemicals.
The 7-Eleven cure.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Leanne and Scott. Excellent information.
Thank you for the invitation.
A lot of good conversation here. Something for us to pass along for certain, not only at work, but at home as well, and friends and family. Just wanted to congratulate again Mark, Stephanie, and Adrienne stepping up and being on the executive team next year. Really appreciate you willing to serve and step up and prepare the agenda and work with key staff here at the county, so it's been a good experience for me, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it as well. Any closing topics for consideration for entertaining a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Have a good evening. Thank you for attending.